The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Would you ever admit to having a favourite child, or as a sibling, is it obvious to you who your parents preferred? Well, author and broadcaster Catherine Carr joins me now to tell us about her new book called Who's the Favourite? Catherine, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And so the basic question is, who is the favourite? Like, is it the oldest child? Is it the youngest one? Is it the middle one? Or is it none at all? Is it a myth?
I don't think it's a myth. I think 74% of parents admit to having a favourite, but they would obviously never say. But I don't think favouritism is as simple as this child is, quote unquote, the best, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. I think you have to sort of go right to the heart of what it is to be a sibling and to grow up with children together in a house, but actually to have very separate experiences of childhood and very separate experiences of your parents. Because you're different personalities with your brothers and sisters, you bring out different sides to your mum and dad. And I think that's one of the places that favouritism can kind of show itself. You could just gel more with one of your parents or one of your siblings. DNA is a funny beast. It mixes up in funny ways too. Mm. So there's so much to say beyond just the idea.
And, you know, your parents are in a very different place when you're born as opposed to when your sibling was born. They're older. They're, I think you've said in the past, they're perhaps more tired. Or if you're the firstborn, they're less tired and they're full of hope and you are their sole focus.
Yeah, and I did get some people on the internet saying to me, I've got a baby that's 6 months old. Are you telling me that I'm not as tired as I'm going to be? And I felt really bad because we all know the first baby's a shock.
It is a shock.
But yeah, I mean, I have an analogy in the book, which is like a river, if you'll bear with me a second. Mm-hmm. And each baby is kind of plopped into that river and floats along. And when the next baby comes, it doesn't arrive in the same body of water. The environment, the weather, whether the river is chuckling or raging, whether the family dog has died, the house has been sold, the mum's lost the job, all of these things, all of these factors which are around each child are different with the arrival of each baby, mm-hmm. including, as you say, whether the parents are knackered or whether they've got loads of optimism and idealism. It's so complex.
I got lost when I was reading about your own, in your story, in your family story, because it is quite extraordinary, because you didn't grow up with all of your siblings.
No, I didn't. My parents, we lived in Holland when I was little. And when I was 11, I'm the middle of three girls. My older sister, Bex, is quite close to me in age. She's 20-ish months older than me. My little sister, CJ, is 6 years younger. We were all living in Holland together as a family of five. But when I was 11, my mum moved out and she took the baby, who was then six, with her. And quite shortly after, me, my dad, and this is where people's eyes can boggle and cross because it gets complicated, but me and my dad and my older sister moved back to the UK. So not only was I separated from one of my siblings, but we were separated by country and just had one parent each. So I think I was predisposed to really think about siblings because growing close to and getting to know my sisters as an adult has been sort of an intentional project. You know, I did it on purpose because I can't take it for granted.
When I was finding out about this, about your story, I wondered whether you grew up feeling that the baby who went to live with your mother, that the baby was the favourite. Did you feel that was your mother's favourite?
No, I didn't feel that. But I think your question is perfect because it gets to the heart of what every child brings into a sibling dynamic, which is like huge main character energy. So I think when I think back to that episode, which was hard, Claire. It was
hard. Yeah.
But not extraordinarily hard insofar as I've spoken to so many siblings and each person I talk to seems to have a crazy story. But back to mine for a moment, I think the thing that blew my mind was how, as an adult, when I talked to my sisters about how hard it was for me, you know, this happened to me, I then realized when I matured that it was so hard for each of them in their own way. So I lost my little sister and I didn't live with my mum and we lost the family home. But my little sister lost her dad and both her big sisters and the family. So stepping out of like your own point of view and into your siblings' point of view, that's a wild ride I would encourage anyone to go on, whether their story is bonkers like mine or a little bit more sort of maybe normal, in quotes.
Yeah, it's interesting. And we don't often do it. I think you're right about the main character energy. You know, when you're thinking about this, you do think about it from your own personal perspective, which of course is natural. But once when you step into your sibling's shoes, you probably will see a different vista, right? You'll see it in a different way.
Absolutely. And there's a guy who wrote a really good book about adult sibling relationships. So this idea of being friends with your sibling when you're older. And he said, I had a long chat with him. I read his book. And at the end, he said, you know what, to put it bluntly, I just don't know what it's like to be my brother.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, yeah, that's true. But also, I think your question gets to this really fascinating area of research and psychology, I guess, which is how we make memories and who stores them, who gets to say they're right or what really happened. Because with our brothers and sisters, I'm quite old, I'm 48, so I think about cine cameras and like home videos more than phones, weirdly, about my childhood. But let's say you're taking movies of your childhood, the movies that your brothers and sisters are taking or the memories they're storing are from a totally different perspective. And so when you get together to share them, sometimes people remember things and you're like, are you sure that happened? Mm-hmm. And that is so fascinating. There's a study in New Zealand that was done about memory, and there were twins, and they asked them to recount a sort of key story of their childhood. And one of these twins had run away from home, right? And the other one had gone looking in the police car for the naughty runaway. But when they asked the twins to remember the story, they both put themselves in the police car as the hero. Now, that can't be true.
Interesting.
Yeah, so interesting.
And what do you think was going on there? That was sort of a learned memory, was it? Or some sort of experience of that time that meant being in the police car was the safe place to be, or it was the right place to be, or you were in less trouble if you were in the police car?
I think exactly. And I learned about memory that the way that, because they're not DVDs, even though I've used the video camera analogy, you don't record something and then that's what happened and you play it again. That's the truth. How and why you remember something is a lot to do with who you think you are, like whether you see yourself as naughty or brave or clever. That sort of memory will be locked in. Uh-huh. And then, of course, every time you replay it, you bring your new context and self to it. So you kind of reevaluate all of these things every single time you get them out of your brain and think about them. So I think in that story, the person who was in the police car wanted to see themselves as maybe the responsible twin or the savior twin or the good twin. And maybe that's the idea they've had about themselves for their whole life.
I want to ask you as well about these conversations you had, Catherine, in 2024 with teenage boys across the UK, because we've been talking a lot about Louis Theroux's Inside the Manosphere. And I think that we talk to our boys in a way where we seem to suggest to them that they all want to be part of the manosphere, that their ambition, their sole ambition is to be a hero of TikTok, YouTube in a very toxic, nasty way. Do you believe that that is what we are doing, and perhaps there's a danger that it might become self-fulfilling?
I've just come off the back of about 5 months of recording girls for a follow-up series, actually. So to make the partner series about the boys is the one you're talking about. And I say this because the girls talked a lot about the boys. The boys shaped the girls' experience.
Okay.
But with both sexes, I think you're absolutely right that there's it's quite hard to get your head around. And it drove me nuts when I was editing it. There's a very funny thing going on, which is about getting attention in the digital world, which, FYI, teenagers don't really think of as separate from the real world like we do.
Yeah.
And getting attention in that digital world and clout and likes and approval or whatever, you get more of it for performing a kind of femininity or a kind of masculinity, which seems really reductive. There's like one kind which seems to get attention. And yet I think in the world there are a lot of normal girls and a lot of normal boys, because I met them and talked to them. But they are caught in this funny knowing space, some of them, of not really wanting to perform this kind of masculinity, but feeling like they need to in order to be popular in the real world by showing that in the digital world. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I you know what? Even some of the characters in that Louis Theroux documentary, I felt that about them. Mm. I felt that they didn't believe what they were saying, but they are working in this attention economy, and this is what you need to do. This is what the cash is in that world.
Yeah, and I'll give you my brand new thought on it, which I had on the train yesterday, Claire, which was I saw an advert for hair loss, which is a big thing with young guys, right? Uh-huh. The fear of hair loss, the prescriptions you can get on the internet illegally, the effects of these drugs on boys' mental health. I heard a friend of a friend's son has just gone to Turkey for some facial surgery to make his face symmetrical. He's 19.
Oh my goodness.
And I thought, I was talking to a friend and I said, but you know what? As women and girls, and I've just spoken to over 150 of them across the whole UK, girls come from a long line of women, grandmothers, aunties, sisters, who know that their appearance is judged and they feel something about how they present themselves to the world. For boys, this looks maxing, this jawline thing, this hairline thing, this manosphere thing feels very new. So it's almost like girls and women are like boiled frogs and men have been like dumped into it with social media, like a rude shock. Mm-hmm. And how our teenage boys are supposed to make sense of that, I do not know. It is wild and awful. It's been wild and awful for girls and women since day dot. But I feel like there's something about this moment which is so sudden for boys. Mm-hmm. That they don't know what to do.
And they don't know what to do with this term toxic masculinity, which is thrown at them from the age of 11 or 12 now, right. too, which is, I think, a really difficult message to send to young boys, because it's like finger wagging, isn't it? You're bad.
Yeah.
You haven't done anything, but we know you're bad inherently because of your gender.
I think it's so harmful. And the fact those two words have like been coupled together, you can't say one without the other. Masculinity is so many more things. Part of it might be toxic, but not every boy is toxic. Mm-hmm. And these boys don't even know, the little boys, the younger boys I spoke to, they don't know kind of what they've inherited in the patriarchy, which serves them and also punishes them. They don't know that. And yet they get these messages quite at tender ages about how they're supposed to be responsible for this whole system that they didn't set up. I think that's problematic. And I've spoken even to my husband about it. And he said it affects him as well. He feels he doesn't want to say very much and he doesn't want to talk to women he doesn't know because he feels that label almost attached to him and he's the mildest, sweetest of men.
Catherine, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us. Catherine Carr is the author of the new book, Who's the Favourite? And Catherine is a broadcaster and podcaster as well and a very interesting person to talk to.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.